Gentlemen, it's Sunday. It means we play two quarterbacks. Weird system, but it works sometimes. Catch a punt, throw it across. Anyway, Scott Roussel, got Zach Barnett, John Bryce, a little weird inside football scoop stuff there. Doug Sams is being a great dad. And I come to you from fallen Baton Rouge. The Aggies, now, I guess they own this whole, it's, I don't know. I just don't know. Never seen players, including your starting quarterback, just openly defy their head coach like happened on the sideline throughout the game last night at LSU. It was stunning to see. Yeah. And I was happy at the end for Tommy Moffitt, to be honest. A little redemption for Baton Rouge man. Gave his life to the Tigers, unceremoniously dumped. When Brian Kelly got hired and is now doing great things at Texas A&M. His wife still lives here. Special place, obviously. Guys rallied for him.
Yeah.
LSU got to reset, right? It's $50 million, but they got to reset.
It's not working. There's no semblance where you can conject now that it's working. It's just you were ahead at home 18-14 going into halftime. You probably should have had a larger lead than that. You hadn't played particularly well, and you get run out of your own stadium a week after. I think it's important to note Vanderbilt didn't win that game by a touchdown last week. Vanderbilt won that game kneeling on LSU's throat at the one-yard line when it had another score there for the taking, when Diego Pavia slid down and did his Johnny Manziel money sign, and that's how the game ended. So it's not just that LSU lost, it's that LSU has further lost footing in the SEC at a time that it's more dangerous than ever to lose that footing, because once you do, it's so much more difficult to get it back. It's harder to get back the ground you lose right now, because the things I've talked about on recent episodes of the Football Scoop podcast are still important, but they're not as important. And in-state talent in Louisiana will always be important. It doesn't mean the same that it meant 5 or 10 years ago. It doesn't, because free agency is alive and well in college athletics. I'll say this, man. Brian Kelly's a hell of a coach when it comes to hiring defensive coordinators, because that's Mike Elko, Clark Lee, and Marcus Freeman, who all have top 10, top 11 teams this morning.
And Blake Baker might have one next year. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I pride myself on trying to pinpoint the exact moment when a coaching tenure hits its peak and it's zenith or the opposite, whatever. I'm struggling with words this morning. But I feel like we all saw that in the third quarter when A&M just started pouring it on LSU. And it was obvious LSU had no answers both in that game and generally. A defense that they're supposed to – hang their hat on was getting shredded. The offense has not looked good at any point this entire season, and really this has never looked like it's working from the get-go. You start with the my family thing, and from that moment Brian Kelly looked like a fish out of water, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, Nick Saban never pretended to be from Louisiana or Alabama. He was a coach hired to win football games. That's all he was. Brian Kelly felt like he had to fit in Louisiana, and the fact that he tried that made him look like a phony. And it's never worked since then. You won the SEC West by tiebreaker in 2022, but you were obviously playing second field to Georgia. You did beat Alabama at home that year, which looks like the peak, but then you've gone ReliaQuest Bowl, Texas Bowl, and now you're staring at 5-4 in the face after you go and lose to Alabama in a couple weeks. So it's never looked like it's going to work. Brian Kelly has no answers. And then I think you mentioned the $50 million figure, Scott, and I think we need to take a step back here. The record in buyout money was paid to Jimbo Fisher at Texas A&M. They got him there because a 10-year market resetting 10-year $75 million contract, and then extended him for no real reason, but they extended him and that reset his, and now the A&M owes him $75 million. Well, and then the same person went and gave Brian Kelly a 10-year, $95 million contract at LSU. And so LSU's AD prides himself on being able to pull big fish. Well, if you give a market resetting contract and overpay, you can get people. But what are the results? Jimbo Fisher failed at A&M. Brian Kelly's failing at LSU. And now you get run out of your own building by Mike Elko, who's doesn't have by any means the skins on the wall that Fisher or Kelly had, but he's just a certified ball coach.
Scott Woodard made those two hires you're talking about, Brian Kelly and Jimbo Fisher. I had a conversation with an agent last week, kind of saw where LSU was trending and said, you know, do you think, I said, Scott Woodward, do you think he makes this call and, pulls the plug on Brian? I understand from speaking with local people here in Baton Rouge that the money is available to do that if he makes that decision. And the agent stopped me and goes, Scott, there's no way LSU was letting Scott Woodward make another decision. He said, I'm just telling you, they're not. I said, LSU's in the middle of a presidential search. They're real close. They're going to hire a new president in a couple of weeks. And he says, at that point, I think you're going to see some change. So we'll see. But it sure feels like change is happening here in the next, towards the end of the season.
Well, they're not done losing. That's the other problem. Like, this is not a moment in the time capsule and you say, okay, we'll bury this because we're going to move forward and we've got these wins and we're going to close with momentum. And no, you don't. You're not going to close with momentum. You're not going to have your NFL draft prospect quarterback back next year because he's going to be in the NFL. You're going to lose other key personnel on both sides of the football. You're just not done losing. You go to Alabama next week. Again, as I mentioned, those three defensive coordinators that were his final three at Notre Dame are a combined 19-4 with their teams on the year. New rankings come out today around 1 and 2 o'clock Eastern, respectively, for the coaches poll and the AP poll. All three of those teams are going to be inside the top 12, which means all three of those teams, those three teams being Texas A&M, Vanderbilt, and Notre Dame, are all viable college football playoff contenders, and you might not leave your state to go bowling at the Poulon Weed Eater Bowl, which, no disrespect, they make a fine machine.
That was amazing.
With LSU being off this week, I would not be surprised if there are staff changes later today.
They make a fine machine. God bless you, John Bryce. That was fantastic. Okay, so we've all kind of known this was going to be a very, very unique and interesting year with coaching changes. We just, you know, can all see it coming. The one I don't say never, but didn't think would happen was Texas. I mean, Steve Sarkisian won the recruiting battle to get Arch Manning. He's finally got Arch playing, not playing at a high level, but he's got next year, and that'll be Arch's senior season. And you just assume Sarkisian will be there. Well, this report comes out yesterday morning before Texas strolled into Stark Vegas, like all good teams do. And it was a stunner, saying this is from The Athletic, Diana Rossini saying that Sarkisian's representatives – Sarkisian is represented by CA, Jimmy Sexton, Ed Moranowitz. Sarkisian's representatives have had conversations with people in the NFL, letting them know he'd be open to returning to the league as a head coach this time. Sarkisian came out after the game. I thought it was a very, I don't know. Let me read to you what Steve said. At the end of his thing, he said, you know, obviously I'm upset because this all happened, blah, 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 blah. But this is how he closed his statement. His statement only went on for 1 minute. And he said, okay, so I've got a small circle when I make decisions on what I do and what I don't do. Nobody would ever speak on my behalf without me knowing. So where that report came from, I'd love to talk to that person because it's absolutely ridiculous. So again, he says, I've got a small circle. No one would speak on my behalf without me knowing. So where did that come from? You know, what Steve didn't say was, guys, There's no way I'm leaving this place. I got Arch Manning come back for a senior season. I'm going to win a national championship here before I would ever consider leaving. He didn't. He said, I got a small circle, and they would never tell people that without me approving it. That was odd.
Yeah, it sounded like he wasn't upset that it happened. It was upset that he got caught, you know, the type of thing when you're in school and you get caught doing something. Like it sounded like Sark said, hey, you know, to his agents, you know, if these jobs came open, I'd be interested to have a conversation. His agents did their job. That got out, and it didn't come from Sark's mouth, but that seems more likely to me than Diana Russini, who's a respected reporter, just making that up out of thin air. And then so you had the weird dynamic play out during the game of when that came out Saturday morning, it was interpreted kind of in Texas circles as, okay, well, you guys want me to hire a play caller. Well, here's my leverage. I'll just leave. I'm going to do this my way. You're not going to force me into hiring someone else. If you're going to force me to hire a play caller, I'm just going to leave. And then you go out and you fall behind by 17 points to Mississippi State on top of how your team's already underperformed this season. It's, and then the tenor kind of turns, all right, well, A, can you leave if this is what it's going to be? And B, why would any NFL team even want a coach that's fallen behind Mississippi State by 17 points after winning by the skin of your teeth at Kentucky? Like, what type of NFL prospect are you even to begin with? And then they came back and won the game, and now you're technically still in the race, but you've got three top 10 teams ahead of you. You're not going to have your starting quarterback, most likely, against Vanderbilt. So you're kind of a dead team walking, but at the same time, you're still in the race. So it's just a really weird dynamic where, as you said, Scott, at no point did he come out and say, I'm going to be in Austin next year. This is where I'm going to be.
Yeah. What was the prognosis on Arch? I didn't see it after the fact.
It's been reported concussion. That's not official, but that's the thinking.
That's what you saw on the field, yeah. JB?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think by the time that Sark addressed it, it was so many hours later that he probably felt like the unprecedented CAA statement sort of spoke for him. I talked to multiple people that had pretty strong knowledge of the landscape, pretty strong knowledge of Sark's reaction to it. I believe that Sark and the Texas coaches maybe were in a staff meeting at the team hotel yesterday morning when that came on the television. And I think that he just sort of like immediately turned it off and was disgusted by it. I don't know that he necessarily acknowledged it verbally with his staff. That wasn't indicated to me, but he very much did talk about it with his representation. And from some people that know what was going on, I'm going to just read you a quote. I don't really understand the purpose of this. They're not having a great year. He's been well taken care of multiple times. This person goes out on a Saturday morning, doesn't check it with anybody related with Texas or his reps, and it's just BS that's laughable. Like his job in the NFL, or excuse me, his job is better than half or more of the jobs in the NFL right now. Rumors are rumors, but I don't get this whatsoever. And then for there not to be any sort of vetting of the information blows my mind. That's the text that came to me. Again, I talked to multiple people that felt like they had a pretty good pulse on the situation. I didn't. You'd be crazy if you're at the top of your sport not to be willing, at the top of your respective profession, not to be willing to entertain the tip top. But I don't think that means that he's engaged in trying to entertain those potentials right now. The NFL has very strict rules on when it can even conduct its hirings and how that process must go. So I don't think Sark's anything more than engaged on trying to find a way to get Texas to score more points. That was Arch Manning's best collegiate performance yesterday. Texas had to show a little more grit and fight than maybe we thought that the Longhorns might have over the course of this season. The last 2 weeks to win in completely different ways, but they won. They're still very much alive as a potential playoff team. They're going to have a chance to be a potential playoff team that might ruin their hated rivals' perfect season in a few weeks. So, yeah, I didn't. This person's right. Like when you do NFL contracts, when you try to drill down on some coaching salaries, I believe Sean Payton is the highest paid NFL coach at around $20 million per year, plus some bonus incentives. There are a few guys out there that are in the $12 to $14 million range, but Sark's creeping up on that range himself. And he's got a great situation there. So when this person says his current job is better than half or more of the head jobs in the NFL, I tend to believe it.
But even still, half or that's 16. So that's 16 jobs you would be interested in leaving for.
No, that's saying it's better than half or more. And that's not saying then you assess it on a case by case basis. That's not automatically saying it's better than half or more is not saying that means there's half or more that he would automatically walk out the door for. It's saying he already has a great situation that's better than at least half of the league in this person's opinion that knows the landscape very well. And by the way, Sark is making right at $11 million plus the potential for way more incentives beyond that. So then you're talking about there's only a half dozen or so NFL jobs paying more than what Sark is making right now.
Right. And that's why coming out with a leverage play would have made no sense for Sark at that time, because you're underperforming and you've just gotten a raise after the last two seasons. Like, you're not going to get a third raise based off of a season where you started number one and are clinging by the skin of your teeth to the top 25.
Right. I don't disagree with that. I don't think Sark did it as a leverage play. I think Sark hunkered down early week and made it clear he believes he's a gifted offensive play caller, that's how he can best serve his program. He's going to continue in that role. But again, like, you know, The Athletic has some great reporters. I wonder how much communication there was between the NFL side and the college side to try and track down some of this information. And also, we're responsible for it here. We have information that we sit on routinely, not because we're scared to report it, but because I think we're being respective of the parties involved.
Happens all the time, for sure. For what it's worth, an NFL head coaching job is so much better than almost every college job right now. College is, you're dealing with changing dynamics. The NCAA is just a disaster. How much you're paying these guys, it's the Wild Wild West. The NFL is very structured, very ordered.
It is.
It's just such a better lifestyle. Everything about the NFL job-wise is better than college right now. But with that said, on the field.
To add to your point, Scott, I don't want to speak for anyone here, but just to add context here is in regards to lifestyle. Sark and his wife just had a child back in April. So he has an infant child that presumably he'd like to spend as much time as possible with. And his current situation does not lend itself to that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I refuse to feel sorry for college coaches on the time management thing for a few different reasons, but mostly because they've cannibalized themselves. I mean, you can trace it to they can get frustrated at the NCAA calendar and this and that, but it's all the coaches that have pushed the envelope on the NCAA calendar that have made their calendars reside in the gray portion of the calendar, not the black and white. So I do get that the NFL parameters and the NFL calendar are better than the college world for sure right now. But I just don't think that Sark was out fishing on the Titans job while he's got a team in the playoff hunt. I guarantee you, I would view the University of Texas job as a better job than the Tennessee Titans job.
I'm speaking purely hypothetically, but if Jimmy Sexton's of the world, right? The guy's dealing with the top 20 college football coaches. It's probably part of their calendar. Check in with them, you know, 7-8 weeks in, and just, you know, hey, we you know, here's proactively as an agent. Hey, looks like we got a shot at doing a new deal here. Or, hey, I'm already getting calls from ADs. There might be something over here. By the way, the NFL is kind of interesting. Seems like you have that conversation amongst agent client, and it's like a 5-minute thing to the college coach. And he's like, yeah, Jimmy, that makes sense. Sure. I mean, explore the NFL because I got Arch next year, and then I'd be willing after that. So, go ahead and explore. If you want to get me in those conversations, sure. But I'm fully invested here at Texas right now, of course. I don't think that's wild. I don't think that's crazy. I think that's part of the agent's job. Whatever. Yeah. All right. Mm-hmm. Let's talk games. So we're 20 minutes in. Let's go a minute here. Zach, I got to go to Texas. They came back and found a way. You warned us all along. They were going to struggle here. Kentucky is kind of a trap thing. No, so not necessarily for that reason, but they really did struggle. They ultimately found a way. But Zach, give me 30 seconds. Texas.
Yeah, the losing Michael Taft, their safety, did not play, and that obviously played a big part in that. They got absolutely ripped to shreds in the secondary. Guys just running free that typically does not happen, and they couldn't run the ball for the seventh straight game. That's not going to change, so they have to scheme around that. And it seems like, I mean, they did a decent enough job. Arch put up big numbers. Caldwell came in and won them the game at the end. But this team has fatal flaws that you're just kind of waiting for someone, especially as the competition gets better over the final month, to expose.
Good, JB.
I was just going to say, what's blowing my mind, and I guess maybe I didn't do a good enough job of listening to you all August and September preach about the trap game component of this, is that finally when Texas returns home to host top 10 Vanderbilt next weekend, it will be Texas's first home game in 42 days. 42 mm-hmm. days. That's scheduling malpractice by the SEC. It truly is. That's ridiculous, and that's really unfair to the Texas Longhorns fans, and for all the decisions that are made in college football right now, and everything driven by money. There's probably not enough made with the fans in mind, because the fans are what have lifted up the sport to these heights, and no fan base should go 42 days without a home game in the heart of its season.
Yeah, Texas obviously is unique because the Oklahoma game counted as a home game. Yeah. But they're not alone. Texas A&M had three straight home games, and now they're paying for it. They're about to go on the road for a third straight week. That should never – you should never, ever have a conference team go three straight road games. That should never happen.
Quick shout-out to Texas receiver. The two catches, one both on the right edge going out, obviously the winner, but the one that Arch threw also. I was like, how did that kid catch that ball and get a toe down, hold a toe down? That was just outstanding. Hell of a lot of heart to come back and get that win, because Stark Vegas was rocking. All right.
Yeah. And, I mean, Mississippi State, sorry, go ahead. That's enough on that game. Go ahead.
Yeah. That's enough. I would agree. Mississippi State. Sorry. Moving right along. To Ole Miss, Lane's offense looked awfully good, like really good. On the broadcast, they're like, man, Oklahoma hasn't allowed any points in the first quarter, and Lane's just rolling down their throat. I think everybody kind of goes, why did he put in Simmons on that third down right at the goal line? And then he brought him back in. You're like, all right, what are we doing here, Lane? But they played well, and they gave up no rushing yards early on. Goldie's defense was interesting.
I think that probably says more about Oklahoma's lack of run game. They to this point in the season, they've only consistently run the ball in South Carolina. So that's been a theme for them, and that's why Mateer didn't have a great game, because he had no support. But to your point, Scott, Lane and the headsets at Ole Miss did more to slow down Ole Miss's offense than Oklahoma did. Putting Simmons in and then was bizarre, and then you had the odd moment that will be hard to top from just overthinking the situation, was when Ole Miss went for it from the Oklahoma 25-yard line on a 4th-and-1. When Oklahoma's offense, you had control of the game. Oklahoma's offense had done nothing. Punt the ball, you'll get it back in three plays. They went for it, and then their play call was a direct snap to the running back, running right into arguably the best defensive tackle room in college football, where the scheme asked for a quarterback to block a blitzing corner. And that corner ended up making the tackle, because surprisingly the quarterback didn't block him and the snap was bobbled. It was just way, way overthinking it by 500 degrees. And fortunately for Ole Miss, it didn't cost them the game.
Yeah, I thought Ole Miss offense looked really good, except when it didn't look really good. I thought it bogged down too much inside the 20. I know they technically scored on all their red zone trips. They did not cash touchdowns on those red zone trips, because if they would have, they wouldn't have been defending a last second Hail Mary toward the end zone. The contest would have been cemented long before that. So a lot of good by the Ole Miss offense. I also think that Lane Kiffin would tell you this Sunday morning that they left a lot of points out on the field. I don't think there's any doubt of that. They should have been in the 40s, and they should have won that game by 11-plus points and not been sweating and needing a crazy special teams turnover that they couldn't cash in with the first down, not getting an incredible gutsy play call to set up first and goal at the 10. And then you have first and goal at the 10, and you kick a 37-yard field goal to still make it a one-possession game. So, again, some great things by Ole Miss, some stuff absolutely left out on the field.
And Ole Miss now, their remaining schedule is South Carolina at home, Florida at home, some FCS school that I don't remember right now, and the then Citadel. At Mississippi State, the Citadel. Okay, and then at Mississippi State. So,
yeah.
They're not in, but they're close to in.
Yeah, they've weathered it. Now, we thought last year after they beat Georgia that they would coast into a playoff bid, and then they found a way to stub their toes at Florida. I don't see that happening this year, but the complete opposite is true of Oklahoma. Oklahoma survived the first half of its season, and now the fade is imminent. And it started yesterday, and now they go to Tennessee next Sunday night. I believe that's going to be the dark mode blackout game for the Vols. Then they go to Alabama 2 weeks after that. Then they get Missouri and LSU at home. And so I think Oklahoma has, yesterday was just so damaging for Oklahoma because, again, my phrase, they're not done losing. And because they lost yesterday, their next loss will eliminate them from playoff contention.
So everything would lead me to go into Alabama, South Carolina next, but John Bryce said last minute Hail Mary, so I got to go with Missouri, Vandy. Holy smokes, did you guys see the final catch on
I'm still not even convinced it was a catch. That ball sure looked like it got friendly with the turf.
It looked like a catch to me, but dude was just outside the end zone. It was just unbelievable. I thought that was great, great theater.
It's good everything. Theater for sure. Yeah. Once again, that's a game that that Vanderbilt should not have been defending its goal line in the last minute. I mean, it had to work hard to be in that position to win the game and take absolutely nothing away from the Doors to do what they did the last 2 weeks, to beat those teams at home is no small feat. And again, like Clark Lee, Doug Samuels, our colleague, makes the point all the time about the job that Cignetti has done. But Cignetti hasn't rebuilt Indiana. He's built Indiana. There was no football heritage there. Vanderbilt's football heritage is well over 100 years old when the SEC was like six teams, including Sewanee. So it's a similar build, not rebuild, by Clark Lee at Vanderbilt, and it's just phenomenal.
Yeah. All right. Alabama, South Carolina. Alabama couldn't have played any worse, and yet they found a way at the very end. South Carolina, what can't you hold on, guys? Any thoughts?
Not surprised. I wasn't surprised that this game was closer than the experts thought. You're Alabama. You're coming off of, you played four straight top 20 teams, beat them all. First SEC team in history to do that over four consecutive calendar weeks. So a letdown going on the road at night. You're not going to – probably not feeling your best, not going to play your best. That wasn't super surprising to me. So I credit to Alabama for getting the win more than I demerit South Carolina for losing. Although it seemed like – it was obvious South Carolina let them score at the end. And John, I had your voice in my head of you always play for a touchdown, don't play for a field goal. College kickers are getting better, but they're not automatic. If I'm South Carolina, I'm trying to make Alabama kick a field goal there.
Yeah, I get your point, but they're not automatic, and we saw it yesterday with Martin Gramatica's son in the USF Memphis game. In a game that USF suffered a come from ahead loss that will haunt the Bulls all season long. But yeah, I'm a firm believer that, especially at the collegiate level, you never stop scoring touchdowns. You never stop. And if you can't score a touchdown with 30 seconds to play in a game and still win that game, then you didn't deserve to win that game.
Agreed. Indiana finally exposed the new UCLA. Anything else need to be said?
I mean, no. Pick six on the second play of the game.
Yeah,
right. It was enough for them to win.
All right. Oregon struggled to find their offense against Wisconsin. Kind of unusual, but it's another win for the Ducks. Hell of uniforms, by the way. Those were fire.
When Dante Moore went down, Oregon went to a walk-on quarterback. And I saw Dan Lanning getting some questions about that. Why? I mean, you've recruited that position very, very well. Why is a walk-on playing? Which I understand. But Dan stood up for his guy. He was like, look, he's our second best quarterback right now. Come watch practice. He's doing his job.
And he was beloved in the locker room.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Ramblin' Wreck. How good is Haynes King?
Yeah, I don't know why we're not getting some more Hainsman trophy talk. he deserves it. It should be out there. What he's doing, they're setting new records every week, and his superlatives are incredible as well. So they're 8-0. They're undefeated this deep into the season for the first time in their history as an ACC member. Did I mention that they're selling their biggest home game of the year? Yeah, maybe I did.
Yeah, a couple times.
How about those Jimbo Fisher quarterbacks? You have Haynes King absolutely killing it at Georgia Tech. And to me, it's an example of why the portal is good. Cause I mean, he's a perfect scheme fit for what Brent Key and Buster Faulkner want to do. You couldn't design a better quarterback, for their scheme than Haynes King. And then you have Connor Wegman at Houston, get a big, big win on the road against the defending Big 12 champions.
Massive win. And Wegman played well, played really well. In that game for them, and bolted into the end zone for a touchdown late that sort of sealed the – like Houston was in control, but I think Connor bolted in from a yard out to make it 24-0, and you knew that it was Blouse's lights, whatever, at that point. Dip your toes in the waters of Lake Minnetonka. It was over.
You mentioned Houston. So strength coach Kurt Hester died yesterday. He was an inspiration for many. The way he lived his life, he literally just poured into all of his players, former players, everybody he worked with. He was an inspiration and will be tremendously missed. Hell of a person. We could talk football, but you want to keep talking football?
Yeah, I'm down to talk football.
All right, let's keep talking football. Miami really struggled with Stanford early on and then just went lights out in the second half. Miami got it back together?
Carson Beck couldn't see his receivers in those camo uniforms.
you stole that from a meme, but I'll allow it. I saw that. Maybe it was Reddit that tweeted out Thursday or Friday, like, this man's coming off a 5-interception performance. You're going to make his receivers harder to find. it was gold. It was gold. How about the absolute evisceration that Utah put on Colorado last night? It honestly looked like a power conference team against a non-scholarship team. I mean, truly, it did. It was 43-0 at halftime. It ended up 53-7. You can do all the permutations and calculations you want, but the technical term is foot off the gas. And that's what happened in the second half of that game. But I've never seen – you've seen some teams hot and roll in and really handle an opponent for a half, but I've never – I don't recall seeing something that appeared to be such a cosmic mismatch as that was last night inside Rice-Eccles Stadium.
It was reminiscent to me of what TCU did to North Carolina in their first game when North Carolina looked like a non-scholarship team. And to North Carolina's credit, they for 2 weeks in a row, they played like a scholarship competitive football team.
Oh, good. Upward basketball, the ACC edition.
how about BYU going in? Yeah. And just finding a way and kind of running away at the end there.
Iowa State will long regret and lament yesterday's game. I think the Cyclones had a a couple of touchdown lead and then threw a pick six, and then BYU got momentum and BYU stayed perfect and played close to perfect once that point in the game arrived, and Iowa State did not. And that was Iowa State's kind of last best chance to stick its flag in the ground and do something meaningful with its season.
Cincinnati keeps winning. Nice home win over Baylor.
I think you're going to see a change at Baylor sooner than later. It's just Baylor's as average gets right now. And they've made a change to Jake Spavital, which has worked. The offense has certainly improved from where it was, but the defense is just not good enough. So he's made the changes he can. He's made the moves he can make to extend himself, and the results are the results. So I think that job's going to open.
Sorry, gents. Michigan handled Michigan State. Nebraska fought with Northwestern. Not very pretty.
That Nebraska was up 21-6, gives up a touchdown, and then on third and four runs absolutely perfect 3-yard route to come up short of the sticks. They punt. Northwestern goes down, scores, get the extra point. And I'm like, all right, how many times have Nebraska fans seen this movie? And amazingly, like seriously amazingly, Nebraska found a way to win the football game when they're like 3-700 in those situations. So, I mean, you beat a not very good Northwestern team by 7 at home. I don't know if that's progress, but you won the game.
And they returned the opening kickoff in the second half for those 7 points. Anyway.
I haven't seen if they've announced yet for game day next weekend, but it might be Cincinnati, Utah. It's not a great slate of games next weekend, and both of those teams are going to be top 25 teams now that are very much factors in the Big 12 Conference Championship race. So just a little food for thought there. Scott Satterfield has his Bearcats 7-1. Just incredible. And speaking of incredible, as we just sort of hit the hodgepodge here, Pittsburgh, another convincing win, rolled NC State. Things are bleak in Raleigh, and that's certainly a situation to continue to monitor. How long does Dave Doran want to do it? How much longer do they want Dave Doran to do it? But that's a bad situation there in the heart of the Research Triangle.
K-State did what they do to Kansas. Amazing. Lance Leipold after the game was like, we're broken. You don't hear Lance speak like that all that often.
That's 17 in a row, I think, in the Sunflower Series. Like, and you had a 19th year starting quarterback in Jalen Daniels. You're never winning.
I mean, yeah, so 17 in a row includes 0-5 for Lance Leipold. And you put in $500 million to renovate your stadium, which is still in progress. You think you pay that money, you should beat your in-state rival more than once every 20 years.
All right. Touching real quickly on some other ones. I did not think Wake would be any good this year. Mm-mm. 5-2 beat SMU yesterday. Pretty good. Kent State has won 3 games straight up. Mark Carney, dudes. Mark Carney,
yeah.
Come on.
He's going to keep that job. He's the interim, but I bet that's good. They're going to make him the full-time head coach.
Very possible. Scott Abel turned around Rice. I know they're only 4-4, but they're 4-4. Beat UConn yesterday in OT in Houston. Pretty good. Iowa whitewashed Minnesota. Woo.
Tim Lester. He's got the Hawkeyes. Tim Lester as your coordinator, Mark Gronowski as your quarterback, and the Hawkeyes have more than a pulse for a change on offense.
We touched on it on Inside Scoop, on Football Scoop, little premium series that we're doing there. In the MAC, Toledo is really having a down year for Toledo. It's kind of unusual. And it's made some agents ask me, Candle said, hey, look, I've done everything I can here. I had an incredible run. It's time to get paid and go be an offense coordinator and then see if I can play that into a Power Four head job. We'll see. JB, you told us early on, maybe I believe before the season started, San Diego State was going to be way better than people realized.
Yeah. They punched their ticket to 6-1 yesterday. It means they are qualified for a postseason. A huge year two upward leap for Sean Lewis and company. And yesterday was really sweet for the Aztecs. It was the rivalry game. They refused. They called it all week. They said, we're not saying the F word. That F word being Fresno. They refused to say it. They borrowed a page from the Ohio State Michigan playbook and just called them TTUN, that team up north. And it worked 23-0. A very methodical 23-0. They were up 10-0 early and then 13-0. And they just completely took the air out in the second half. Fresno State could do nothing. I thought San Diego State, in talking with their staff, felt confident going in that they could win that game. I don't think that anybody expected it to be a shutout in that sort of controlled environment.
How about Southern Miss, JB? Last year they had one win, made a change, Will Hall, to Charles Huff, who had been phenomenal at Marshall. And Huff comes in, and they got six wins on the board? Six wins.
They're going bowling. Huff Daddy just doing some big things. He's got them dancing down there in Hattiesburg. 6-2. They're still a factor in the conference race. One of those losses early season to Mississippi State to open the year. And then the other one at Louisiana Tech, where they just didn't play well, but they've won four in a row. They've won 6 out of 7. They got Butch Jones in Butch Jonesboro, Arkansas, for their next game on Saturday, November 8th. So they got a couple of weeks to collect themselves and reflect on being bowl eligible, which is the first time since Will Hall guided the Golden Eagles to a bowl game maybe 3 years ago in a 500 season. So big things for Huff. He's got Braylon Braxton triggering the offense, a guy that we wrote about and spotlighted on Football Scoop because he turned down money from some power conference programs, both to be a starter and to be a premium paid number two quarterback at some power programs. And there he is. It would be one of the most phenomenal stories. It might be the most encapsulating story of what college football is right now. If Charles Huff can take this Southern Miss squad to play for a conference championship after winning that conference championship at an entirely different school last year.
That'd be incredible. Huff had one of the best lines of the night. He said, hey, this is great and all, but you got to keep winning. He's like, if we finish the season with 6 wins, then we got to go to Shreveport, play a bowl. Ain't going to be anybody happy to be going to Shreveport. He's right about that.
He clearly doesn't know about those weed eaters.
I mean, you said they make a fine machine. Navy is undefeated.
So I'm very excited. I'm going to write about that this midweek at Football Scoop because Navy goes to North Texas this week. And Texas just set the AAC record with 608 passing yards, I believe, Drew Messemaker, which included a dropped wide open 54-yard touchdown pass. So this easily could have been 650 plus. 2007, Navy went to North Texas and won that game 74-62. So we're going to remember that game this week as we could see maybe not 130 points, but easily 100 plus because both of these offenses are as good as it gets in college football. Blake Horvath. This is a kind of a rote comment, but Blake Horvath should be getting Heisman consideration for what he's done. He's piloting that offense like a Navy fighter pilot.
He is, and we should be talking more, and we have talked about Drew Cronic being a Broyles Award, not only a candidate, he's got to be a finalist. He's got to be in that top 15 that gets pared down to 8, that gets pared down to 6 or 4 or whatever the path is. I can't recall immediately off the top of my head, but there's not an assistant coach anywhere in college football who's had a more profound impact than Drew Cronic the last 2 years at Navy, and this further cements that. And I think Drew Cronic has a great chance to be an FBS head coach much sooner than later. Let's not forget he took Lenore Ryan at the D2 level to unprecedented success for that program very quickly, turned around the Mercer Bears. And now you got Mike Jacobs doing great things there after also having done great things at Lenore Ryan. And so Drew Cronic, we wrote about it in a recent Intel piece. He's starting to get a lot of looks. And I watched Drew Cronic at a place like James Madison if the Dukes can't hold on to Chesney, and I think they're going to have a hard time holding on to Chesney.
A head coach can turn the program around just like that. Temple, understand Drayton, was just – they were terrible. Casey Keeler comes in. All the dude does is win football games. They're 5-3. Nice win over Tulsa on the road last night. Huff comes in, goes from one win. He's got 6 wins midseason. Casey Keeler's got 5 wins on the board.
I mean, we're looking forward to a cycle where the consensus is that there's going to be more good jobs and good candidates. Casey Keeler wins. I mean, I don't know if he's a fit at a certain place, but you could do a hell of a lot worse, and plenty of schools will, than do Casey Keeler. I mean, the guy's been a professional football coach or a head football coach since about 1972 and racked up like 497 wins for a reason.
It was UMass, but Dringle's team just put up their 5th win. Nice job up there at Central Michigan.
Yeah, I was getting ready to touch on them. I'm actually wearing the Central Michigan swag today in honor of those guys. 5-3, the battle for the victory cannon next Saturday at Waldo Stadium in Kalamazoo. Until yesterday, Lance Taylor had his Western Michigan Bronx undefeated in MAC play. Close loss for them at Miami, but this has been a big bounce back year for Lance Taylor and the Western Michigan program. That's a low-key, really good rivalry, that Central Michigan-Western Michigan rivalry. There's not a lot of real estate separating those two programs. And, again, a bounce-back year for Lance Taylor and what he's doing, especially the way he's lost coordinators there from Espo on the defensive side of the ball to Billy Kosh, who, by the way, just won his 12th game in a year and a half at Stony Brook. And if I'm not mistaken, they'd won 13 games total in the 5 or 6 years prior to his arrival. So ruminate on that for a minute. But the battle for the victory cannon next Saturday in Kalamazoo, Michigan, is a big one. And either Western Michigan will climb to its 5th win or Central Michigan will gain bowl eligibility in year one under Matt Drinkle, who's an FBS head coach for the first time ever, and in a program that was in absolute disarray when he got there, that had been embroiled into the Connor Stallions cheating scandal at Michigan. So really phenomenal work. And it's Drink and it's offensive coordinator Jim Chapin, it's defensive coordinator Coach Cronin, and then general manager Aiden Upfer has done a fabulous, fabulous job with that program.
Couple of FCS notes before we get out of here. Obviously, the Bison handled business in a big way. That's always Bison. Fun.
Yeah, they told South Dakota State bye, son.
Friday night, the Pandas came down and just smacked that. They appreciated the fireworks after the game, after they celebrated their win at Sac State. That was fun. Good job. I'm still waiting on Montana to send me a locker room video, just letting you know. Presbyterian had a chance to go 8-0. Just an incredible story, non-scholarship. And Dayton got him pretty good. So, Dayton's a very, good, yeah. Very good football team.
Dayton and Drake have kind of been the toast in that league for a bit. So, we'll see. But, yeah, Presbyterian, Steve Englehart, those guys, Dan Owen, the defensive coordinator, just doing some big things. And I know for a fact that what they're doing at the FCS level is being paid attention to at the FBS level right now. Because when you win Absolutely. Without resources like that, when you win without scholarships, and until yesterday you had the nation's longest winning streak, that's some heady stuff.
Last one I'll mention, you mentioned earlier Mercer. Mercer's offensive output yesterday was historic. Look it up. Crazy stuff.
Yeah, weren't they like 800 yards or something?
Yeah, like just absurd. Me and mine did not appreciate that, but it happens. All right, gentlemen, any closing thoughts? We're nearly an hour in.
No,
we've reached the point in the calendar where the mid-afternoon games start in full daylight and end under darkness, and that's only going to continue, obviously, with daylight savings. We've also reached a point in the calendar where we can watch the progress of this podcast as the sun rises in Scott's office The shadows change from one of the days.
Yeah. All right. I'm looking ahead for next weekend. South Carolina's at Ole Miss, Georgia Tech, NC State, Oklahoma, Texas, Texas Tech, K-State at K-State. Cincinnati, Utah, obviously. Penn State, Ohio State. Ooh, Ohio State's cool. Buddy, that one might be worth watching just to see what they do. Vandy's at Texas, Georgia, Florida.
I mean, I'm telling you, the best option for game day is Cincinnati, Utah. There's not another good. I mean, you could go Oklahoma, Tennessee, and bill it as a playoff eliminator, which is what it is. I mean, the loser of that game officially sees its season end and is no longer in the CFP discussion. So you could do that, but I just think Cincinnati, Utah would be a more compelling game day scene. But who would have ever thought we would be on the opening weekend of November when we have games like Georgia, Florida, Penn State, Ohio State, Notre Dame, Boston College, Ole Miss, South Carolina, and we're sitting here saying the best option for game day is Cincinnati at Utah. What a world.
I hope they go to Oklahoma at Tennessee just for the comedy factor after everyone yelled at them for going to another SEC game. Just to go SEC again would be hilarious.
My closing thought is I don't know if I've been more excited for an SEC shorts for tomorrow than I mean, first of all, Vandy Pitt showed up and in real life and was the toast of the town. And Vandy, I mean, I saw the Christmas card pictures flying around last night. SEC shorts, A&M donkey slapping LSU in Baton Rouge at night. It's going to be epic. I'm a fan. SEC shorts, good job, boys.
Real quick, shout out Tarleton State, 9-0, a very convincing road win against Eastern Kentucky yesterday. Walt Wells has done a really nice job with the Colonels program, and they had just knocked off Jeff Ferris and Austin Peay a couple of weeks prior. So Tarleton State being 9-0 absolutely was not on my bingo card. Neither was Tennessee Tech continuing its unbeaten surge under Bobby Wilder and what he's done there. Now they might have the nation's longest winning streak. I think 8-0 this year and won their last four last year. So they're right around 12 games in a row. Phenomenal work there. Austin Peay got back on track. A lot of great football being played at the FCS level.
Football Scoop Podcast. We love doing this. So we're here on Sundays, Tuesdays, Thursdays. Well, friend, we certainly appreciate it. Everybody have a great Sunday. Peace.